Hey, Hillary. Thanks for coming on.
Of course. Happy to be here.
I'm very excited for our conversation today. We've got a lot to discuss. You've got a very interesting and distinguished resume and work. You're a neuroscientist. You work at Wayne State University. You're an assistant professor. And your research, I mean, you know, focuses on all kinds of things. But today, we're going to be talking about meditation and the endocannabinoid system. And there's a lot to discuss. So I'm excited to talk to you. So thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited as well.
So maybe let's start out with the meditation side of things. What are some of the things that you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, so meditation has always been really interesting to me. In terms of the neuroscience side of things, it's really taken off over the past couple decades. And it started with people studying Buddhist monks while they were meditating, because mm-hmm. they were reporting very, pretty dramatic things that they could actually like lower their pain levels, lower their stress levels through doing something like meditation. And they basically said, neuroscientists, come and study us and see if this actually works and see how it works in the brain.
Right.
So since that point, there's been a really robust literature looking at these techniques and actually showing that they do actually modify brain activity. And over time with practice, they can actually modify structural aspects of the brain, which is really exciting. And it's really been a paradigm shift, you know, in terms of the field. And I'm in psychiatry. That's my home department, where we usually think about using drug therapies. But something like meditation that's really behavioral, that, you know, even three-year-olds can use, is really exciting to me to, take control of your pain and anxiety and stress and all the things that we've been talking about with COVID.
Yeah. No, it's really fascinating. And it's extraordinary that it's a technique that's been around for, you know, thousands of years. And it's something that's innate to our, you know, our sort of tendencies, or it's sort of like a natural way for people to regulate themselves and to live their lives. And so it's cool that science is, you know, moving in that direction towards figuring it out. Because, I mean, if it is something that can be utilized by people and kids and anyone really, then it's certainly something worth investigating, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And in the population we work with, so we work primarily with children and adolescents. And mm-hmm. I got into this work working with a group of kids with cancer. And for them, like having something that they can use, that they can use any time of the day to take control over their emotions. And if they're, you know, getting cancer treatments or getting their port started, it's something really easy. It's very empowering for them. And kind of back to your question, like, how did I get into this area? I met a Rabbi G, who's the founder of Kids Kicking Cancer, which is, at this point, it's in like 9 different countries. It's wow. a nonprofit organization that uses martial arts-based techniques to help kids with cancer. And they've expanded to other populations, like sickle cell, chronic pain, and more recently, school children. But they were using a lot of these like meditation and mindfulness-based techniques. And of course, like the physical movement that you think of with karate, like the punches and things like that, which also has benefit. But I was really interested in that because, you know, as a person who's really interested in studying anxiety in children and stress in children, that was really appealing in that there wasn't a lot of literature in kids specifically. And if you have a kid, you know that like the brain of an adult is so different from the brain of the child. So it's not enough to just kind of infer what's happening, you know, in this neuroscientific research on adults. You really have to study kids, you know, and meet them where they're at.
Right. I mean, it really is amazing. And so what kind of meditation techniques are you looking into?
Yeah, so this is something that I kind of learned when I joined this area, was that there are so many different types of meditative techniques.
Right.
And mindfulness, as kind of an umbrella term too, often has different definitions. So that's something that the field has been working on, is getting these more concrete definitions so we can actually piece them apart empirically, you know, study different techniques and see, you know, how they affect the brain, which techniques are better, you know, for different ages or different populations. So the program that I work with, Kids Getting Cancer, they do a variety of different techniques as part of like their standard classes. And they're also in the hospitals when kids have, again, like stressful procedures happening. But they do a lot of breathing techniques. So their kind of hallmark technique is called the breath break. That's breathing in and breathing out. And I like that name too, because it really, like, you can put a stop on anything that you're feeling. And again, like, using that technique whenever you're feeling stressed is really beneficial. But also they do like body scans and other types of meditations as well.
Yeah. And that makes sense, because, you know, breathing is such a natural phenomenon for us, that simply being able to, you know, direct your attention towards it and essentially like ground yourself or refocus where your attention's at, can really, you know, provide that needed relief or control, even, you might say, over various emotions or pain or discomfort or whatever's going on. It's always extraordinary to me when I do it myself and I'm like, how did that just happen? Like, I was just breathing and then it did all these like fancy things inside. And I mean, so what does that, how does the breathing help? Like, what systems does it work on?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, like, for those who have not tried anything like this, it sounds a lot like woo-woo, you know, but there is really a lot of empirical literature showing that this does actually help. And the breath is really the quickest way that you can take control of your autonomic nervous system, which controls things like fight and flight response. Right. And like you said, it kind of brings you back to something that you can focus your attention on. And in fact, like, one of the first things that they teach kids when they're teaching them mindfulness techniques is focusing on your breath, just because it's something that, like you said, everyone does. It's something that's always going to be there, and it gives you kind of a point of focus. And it's different from other things. So like, if you have pain or negative emotions, so if you're feeling stress, it's not like ignoring those things. It sounds kind of counterintuitive that mindfulness is actually recognizing those things, but it's recognizing it and then just being okay with it. Because like we tell the kids, you know, all of these emotions are natural. And in the brain, I don't know if you've ever seen Inside Out, that movie, but that's kind of one of the messages, is that all of these emotions are a natural part of being human. And just recognizing that and just being okay with it is really powerful. So, I mean, they're still studying how these things affect the brain, but we've done a couple of interesting studies looking at kids while they're meditating, or just what mindfulness looks like in the brain in kids. And what we're starting to see is that it's a very different thing from like distraction, or from trying to effortlessly, you know, purposefully like control your emotions if you're feeling mad. So mindfulness looks like it's more like bottom up. So it's like a dampening of that, that emotion reactivity, versus like things that are, you know, distraction or other kind of like cognitively intense ways to control your emotion are more prefrontal cortex driven. So that's the top of the brain. And that's really interesting to me, because kids have a very immature prefrontal cortex. That's what you always hear about, how the prefrontal cortex is one of the last things to develop. So the fact that mindfulness kind of circumvents that circuit and it doesn't rely on that immature brain area is really important for us, because it could be a very powerful technique for kids. And it looks like it is. I mean, mindfulness programs are all over the world, in classrooms and wherever kids are, really.
No, it is. It's extraordinary. And it's cool that it's something that can be accessible not only once that prefrontal cortex develops, which, you know, happens like much later in developmental years, right? Like well into mm-hmm. your 20s at least till it's
exactly
firmly yeah. established. So let me, so where does the attention part of the brain lie? Or I mean, maybe I'll phrase that question better. Like which part of the brain or your nervous system sort of controls attention focus? Because for me, what, like, you know, as we said, like there's various types of meditation and it serves different purposes a lot of the time, but there's a lot of common themes between them. So like one type of meditation is the type where you focus on something in particular, right? Mm-hmm. So you're training your attention to hold onto one thing. Now that can be something outside of you, so it can be an object or a, you know, a rock or something, or a tree or something like that, or it can be like an internal focus, so it could be something like focusing on a word or a phrase or something like that, or there's like the focus of attention on just like bodily sensations or mm-hmm. emotion, I guess, you know, movement, and so how does that tying together?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And you're kind of hit on some different types of meditation as well, because like even the mm-hmm. phrase, like if you're repeating a mantra, that mantra recitation looks like it engages more of like motor systems in the brain. Because mm-hmm. when you're speaking, you're essentially doing a movement. So that, I mean, there's different parts of the brain that are specialized for different things, but broadly as a field, what we've come to know is that the brain is a lot more complicated than we thought, and that a lot of systems are working together to do a lot of different things. So there's yeah. not like one area that's involved in like emotion or attention even, but broadly there are some areas that we know are relatively more involved in those processes. And I think those details are still really being worked out. But mm-hmm. As far as I know, one of the common patterns that kind of comes up when you're focusing your attention or when you're meditating, as you said, is there's a reduction in a brain system called the default mode network, or the DMN. Okay. And that brain network is really interesting for a lot of reasons. It's a network that's really involved in rumination. So if you're thinking about something you did yesterday that you're, you know, upset about, something in the past that has been really dragging you down, like a past trauma, also things in the future. So if you're thinking, if you're worried about like an exam coming up or something, anytime you're basically inside your own mind and you're thinking about things that are not happening right now.
Right.
And the example that I always use is, I'm sure everyone's done this, when you're driving and all of a sudden you realize that you're at home and you didn't mean to go home, but your brain is just kind of on default because you're right. so in your head. So that default mode is really prevalent then. And it's linked to mind wandering, mm-hmm. Which can be beneficial. So mind wandering is good for things like creativity, but too much mind wandering is linked to things like depression and anxiety. So wow. one of the really cool things that all these different types of meditations that you just mentioned seem to do together is they kind of turn off that default mode network activity, which makes sense because you're not in the past or in the future. You're in the present moment. Mm-hmm. And what your brain is doing is switching between those different brain states. So instead of being kind of lost in thought, you're focusing on, like you said, like an external sensation or an internal sensation. And you're actually turning off that default mode network and you're engaging your attentional networks. Right. And back to your earlier question about attentional networks, again, those are kind of distributed through the brain, but it looks like we do have one system that's responsible for kind of shifting your attention. Mm-hmm. Like let's say you're reading a book, you hear a loud noise. So there's a brain network that comes online called the salience network. And salience just means like biological relevance. So if you're, you know, reading a book and you hear a gunshot, your salience network is going to say, disengage from reading book, like pay attention to what's in my environment, because it could be, you know, life threatening in that case.
Right.
So that network really shifts you out of whatever you're doing and pulls in other networks. And in this case, if you're mind wandering, you say, oops, I'm mind wandering. you're going to shift out of that default mode network state and bring in those focus attention states, which are really prefrontal cortex and parietal lobe driven. But again, it's a variety of different areas.
Right. And so when, you know, you're up, so how much of the day is spent in with this sort of like default mode? I suppose that's a, you know, big question, and it would depend on the person, right?
Sure.
And presumably, like, it changes as well, depending on what's going on, what your internal state is, you know, how things are going. But so a lot of time is spent in default mode, right? Because you've learned how to just exist, and it just becomes a pattern of behavior, and you just keep doing it because it works to some degree, at least, to keep going, right?
Exactly. Yeah. There's been some really cool studies actually where they like ping people on their phones throughout the day and ask them like, hey, were you just mind wandering? And you're exactly right. A lot of people most of the time are actually mind wandering, no matter what they were doing. So if they were cleaning, if they were driving, they were mind wandering. And a lot of those studies have actually, they've asked them not only are you mind wandering, but kind of rate your level of happiness right now. And the more times when people were mind wandering, they tended to rate their happiness as much lower, probably because they're kind of focusing on or ruminating on things that happened in the past. But you're exactly right. It does depend on kind of individual characteristics. Again, you know, people who are more susceptible to depression, for example, they're thought to tend to spend more time in that kind of mind wandering or default state. But one of the other cool things I wanted to mention about mindfulness is that people differ just on their level of mindfulness, which is their ability to kind of stay in that present moment. And we did a study where we were looking at how mindful kids were. They didn't do any mindfulness training programs, but just how they varied on mindfulness and how that related to their brain. And one of the cool things that we found was that more mindful kids reported lower anxiety levels, which is exactly what we'd expect. And also their brain was more able to shift out of that default mode state. So they didn't necessarily spend more time in that default mode state, but when they were in there, they weren't in there as long as the other kids, which is really cool because they're kind of able to recognize that they're possibly ruminating, shift out of that state. And it looks like they're more kind of flexible in their ability to shift out of different brain states, which was really cool.
Yeah, that is cool. And I mean, you know, the other part about it is that you never ruminate on good things.
Right. Unfortunately.
Like, yeah. It's not. And I mean, I guess that kind of makes sense from like an evolutionary perspective where you're like, no, it's more important to think about the bad things that might kill you than it is to think about the nice thing that happened to you yesterday. You know, your brain can only do so much with the good stuff that happened, but the bad stuff you need to learn from, or you need to solve a problem, or you need to, or you think you do at least, right? You need to sort this or that out.
Yeah, absolutely. You just hit on like a evolutionary theory of depression, and I know you got a psychologist parent, so that was awesome.
Thanks. Yeah. I have a psychologist parent, and you know, I've also dealt with depression and anxiety myself, and so coming from a sort of somewhat of a lived experience of it, and it's a very peculiar thing, right? And it's been around for like ages. It's one of the oldest known diseases or conditions or whatever you want to call it. I mean, I think they used to call it like, oh, I suppose there's various words, but melancholy or melancholia back in the day. Or, you know, even if you read like ancient Greek, like literature, they speak about various kinds of depressions and mood states and things like that. And so it's been a problem for humans for a while. But you know who never gets depressed? Animals. Or not never.
That's true.
Actually, I mean, I don't know if that's categorically true, but I say that because I was thinking about what you had mentioned about how some kids are naturally more mindful or able to at least switch out of this default mode and not ruminate so much. And it's interesting because other animals, non-human animals, don't do that. I mean, they do that all the time, rather, right? Where their state of being is very present, and they don't get lost in thoughts. At least I don't think so, but it doesn't seem to be the case, right?
Yeah, that's the tricky part. Yeah. You can't ask your dog what they're thinking.
No. Like, the dog's not... the dogs don't seem to, like, hold grudges or, you know, like, remember problems or think about future. They're sort of just very present and just very in the moment. And they deal with, of course, extreme challenges a lot of the time, as all creatures and life forms do. But there isn't that level of... making it into like a conceptual problem for yourself, right? That you sort of have to think about endlessly. Because otherwise, I would imagine you would see animals doing things that humans would do, like, you know, hoarding resources or frantically hunting to try and preserve food for as long as possible and, you know, constantly being worried about what might happen in the future or whatever it is. It's much more of a like, day-to-day kind of existence of like, where am I getting food today? Where can I sleep tonight? Who's around? You know, is there threat or not threat? And so it would make sense that, at least to me, the non-expert, that for kids in the beginning, that their behavior is very similar to that, right? Because they haven't been... civilized, I suppose, is a word that you might use.
Jaded.
Or, yeah, exactly. Or just brought into the human thinking world of existence that that's so much of our time is spent in, right?
Yeah, in that respect, teaching kids these techniques early on is really good for kind of setting the stage for them to carry through, you know, as they become adults. So that's why there's even more emphasis on teaching kids these techniques very early on.
Yeah. And so there's, you know, as we said, there's lots of techniques that are available to people. And so you said that the breathing one is a good one for kids. Movement, presumably, is also very good because kids like to be active and move around and, you know, learn about their bodies and feel what all different things feel like and just interact with a new world for them. And so... that must be pretty helpful too, right?
Yeah, I mean,
there's various kinds of that, like martial arts.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the example that I use always is that if you tell a kid to go sit down and meditate, like they're just going to be like, no. But if you pair it with something like yoga or martial arts even, where it becomes fun. I mean, kids do things, they spend time doing things that they love and that they think are fun. Like that makes it an even more powerful package. I did want to say really quick back to the animal thing. Yeah. So there are like animal models of depression. They're, you know, they're not the greatest just because, again, we have no idea what's happening, you know, inside the mind of a mouse or a rat. But there are certain behavioral markers we can look at. But in the same token, I think you're exactly right. And I just, on my own podcast called Brainstem, shout out. I interviewed someone who actually does animal assisted therapy, and she uses an animal, uses a guinea pig as a model of mindfulness. Cause like you said, if you're holding a guinea pig like that, it is in the moment. And that's a really good model for people. So just wanted to mention that.
Yes. I refer to my dogs as the Zen masters of the house.
They're pretty lazy.
Yeah. No, they're not. They're very active, but they're very present with everything that they do. And just being around them just evokes that in me and in people, it seems, because, you know, they're not judging. They're not concerned about who you are, what you've done, or who you think you are, or what they think of you, you know, in general, you know, I guess in some cases it might be a bit different, but generally speaking, it's like, you can just be there with the animal, right? And you don't, there's no pressure to say or do anything or be a certain kind of person, or they're not going to judge you for things you've done like you judge yourself or whatever it is.
Absolutely.
And so it's incredibly peaceful and healing to just be around animals. And so it makes sense that there's all kinds of animal therapies, you know, even like, I guess you see it more a lot these days with like support animals. You even get like emotional support animals, which is different, but you know, helpful. And so why not? But yeah, so animals are an extraordinary study. And I guess, you know, if I think about it, like they could get depressed, you know, like in cages and isolation and various forms of things that would depress anyone or anything, would definitely have an impact. But it would be interesting to know like how the experience of it is different, like from a human, right?
It's a million dollar question. Yeah. So interesting.
Well, let's just figure out how to talk to dogs and see what they have to say about it, you know?
Yeah, there's some really cool studies, if anyone is interested, where they don't talk to dogs, but they put them in an MRI machine and way more behave than my dogs. My dogs would not be able to do that, but they put them in an MRI machine and they show them like pictures of their human versus strangers and things like that. So there are a little bit of ways that you can study, you know, how animals process information. But of course, we still lack that subjective experience. Like, what is it actually like to be a dog?
Yeah. No, it's true. And it's not, it's weird how we sort of use language. It, you know, it's a bit limiting in that we say like humans think and dogs don't, but you know, it's probably not quite true. It's just the thought is different and the experience of it is different.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because if you have a brain that's functioning, presumably what's happening is some kind of thinking. But I guess humans have that like higher order thinking where we can think about our thinking. Something like that.
That theory of mind.
Yeah. A big question that a lot of people are looking into at the moment, you know?
Yeah, this is why the brain is so cool, though, because we just jump from like 20 different topics that all neuroscience, you know, touches.
Yeah. No, it's awesome. I love it. I love just learning about it and how complex it is. And I mean, it's extraordinary how much we know and yet how little we know at the same time. Right.
And that's like, something when I talk to kids in the classroom too, I tell them that you read like a science textbook and you think that, okay, we've got it all figured out. But in reality, there's so much, like you said, that we need to know about the brain in particular.
Yeah.
So we need more scientists to really come on board and make new discoveries every day. And that's really my favorite part of the job is really just pushing the boundaries of what we know and what we don't know really excites me. And again, I think we need more young people to get involved and get excited about science.
Yeah, for sure. I'm having a woman on the podcast in a few weeks who's talking about teaching kids science and it's important and, you know, just teaching parents how to integrate science into their conversations with kids. And even without knowing the answers necessarily, it's just to engage that curiosity and to stimulate the mind in a way that, you know, because science is kind of the like, well, it's one of the last bearers of real truth in the world at the moment, right? It's not opinion. I mean, there's opinion in it, obviously, and you know, there's various kinds of research bias and whatever. There's limitations.
Scientists are humans too.
Yeah. Yep. But fundamentally, it's like everyone's trying to figure out something that we can all agree on. And it's at least in descriptive in nature, right? So that it's like, oh, well, this is how it works. And then, you know, other scientists get to do cool shit and make cool do cool technology and medicine and all fun things like that to help people along. But anyway,
but you're exactly right. I mean, it's the one thing where you can actually objectively go out and test it for yourself. And that's kind of the point. Because if I were to go to a scientific conference and say like, hey, this is my opinion, I don't have any data to show it, they would say, well, I don't care about your opinion. Like, show me the data. And then I want to go back to my lab and replicate it. So you're exactly right.
No, it's good. And that's not to say that it's always correct, right? Like, we learn new things all the time and it's, you know, it develops and it improves and we have working hypotheses, I suppose, is the technical term, so that we don't get stuck saying this is the answer. It's like, no, this is what we think the answer is at the moment. We've got good evidence to support it. But if new, better stuff comes out, then we'll move in that direction.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, that's the scientific method. And I am really excited to listen to that episode because I think having more people just understand the scientific process, and like you said, that it's mm-hmm. always evolving, and that, you know, what we think right now is based on a hypothesis, which is just an educated guess based on what we know from prior studies. But what we know today is more than what we knew yesterday, and it mm-hmm. constantly evolves. And to be, you know, very rigorous or dogmatic in your thinking, you're not being a scientist. You need to be very open-minded.
Yeah. And it's hard for people because we don't like to have our beliefs and knowledge challenged, right? Because it feels mm-hmm. like a bit of a personal attack sometimes. That's what science is. I mean, you can see that everywhere where it's like, you know, people will get mad at doctors or scientists because they're, you know, now saying what we used to say is not what we're saying now. I mean, mm-hmm. and so people will be like, well, then how can we trust anything? And then, mm-hmm. I understand that thought process, or I can empathize with it because it's frustrating where you're like, well, if you're saying what you said last time was wrong, well, then how can mm-hmm. I trust what you're saying now? And, I mean, I guess it's just a little bit of, I don't know, maybe it's a misunderstanding of science or just some frustration that people get involved in. But ultimately, it's fine, you know, like it comes out anyway, the truth comes out, and it takes a couple generations.
Yeah, I mean, the more you get into science, like the more specialized you become, the more you understand mm-hmm. the nuances in the data and that it's not always black and white. And so when you're talking about things like for the public, of course, you want to be a little bit more black and white. But for a scientist, that's really difficult because it's never black and white. Right. So I think it is frustrating for people, and I understand that, where they see someone else who has a totally different opinion that's like, and they're very confident in it, and it's because they don't have any of that scientific expertise. Mm-hmm. So I think the more, like you said, we can shed light onto the process and get citizen scientists, like get people involved in the scientific process, and make that a really big part of education in general, like the more they will understand that this is a process that evolves every day and it gets better every day.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, you know, we've come enormous ways in terms of scientific understanding just in the last 200 years, never mind like mm-hmm. 1,000 years. You know, I saw a meme like online the other day. I can't remember which brand it was for, but it was like, these doctors recommend this cigarette brand. Right. And this was an ad that was being placed, you know, like in a newspaper or something like that. And at the time, I mean, assuming it wasn't some like, you know, evil plot or scam or something like that, assuming it was just like, you know, doctors thought it was fine at the time. Mm-hmm. And so they were like, oh, this is what we recommend or whatever. And then obviously it's like paid endorsements. But even so, you know, like today, like that doesn't happen. I would hope not.
Yeah, I mean, like we said, scientists are people. They're good scientists. They're bad scientists. I think the cigarette example is really interesting, and I used to bring that up in one of the classes that I co-taught because, at that time, that's what the evidence was showing. There was no data showing that it has really long-term negative effects, but part of the problem with that is like usually the way to test that is kind of the gold standard, which is a randomized controlled trial where you say, okay, this group is going to do drug A, this group is going to do drug B, we'll randomly assign people, we'll follow them over time and see what happens. Mm-hmm. And that's really like the top tier of like evidence if you're in science. With smoking, that's not something that we can ethically do. We can't say, hey, Shane, you know, you're in the cigarette smoking group, you're in the placebo group, like you're not going to smoke, and we'll just see what happens. We'll track you over time. Yeah. So we rely on kind of a second tier of evidence, which is called an observational study, where you track people, a lot of people, over a long period of time. And the outcome that we found was cancer, which isn't an immediate thing. It takes mm-hmm. decades to actually show up. So that evidence didn't show up until much later. And that was part of the problem, was like at the moment, like that was the current state, but we didn't have that evidence yet, which took a really long time, you know, which finally showed us that smoking has a variety of negative effects mm-hmm. on the body.
No, for sure. And it's it's even more complicated when you do things over long-term studies, because there's so many other mm-hmm. factors that can come into it, right?
Absolutely.
And so to make the inferences or the deductions, I don't know what the right word is, to say that, oh no, it definitely was the cigarettes and it wasn't this part of your lifestyle or your genetic predisposition, or it was that, or, you know, it's very difficult to say for sure. But, you know, we do the best we can, right?
Exactly. Yeah, you're exactly right. Like, if you're a smoker, are you more likely to not exercise or eat less vegetables or these other things? And is that mm-hmm. really accounting for that association? Yeah, you're exactly right.
And so, I mean, that leads us into like an interesting part about like cannabis now, which has been mm-hmm. like legalized everywhere, or it will be sort of relatively soon. And, you know, we don't yet know exactly how that's going to go in 50 years from now, and or what the real long-term effects will be, if there are any, which there may or may not be. I mean, I don't know. Like, what are the studies kind of saying these days about it? Because I know you're studying how like CBD can be used as treatment in kids, right? Which is the non-psychoactive form of it.
Yeah, exactly. So cannabis is a super interesting topic, because you're exactly right. Like, in general, the legalization and the public's view on it has really outpaced the science in this area. Mm-hmm. And that's for a couple reasons, but I would say kind of the main reason is because it's been really difficult for scientists to even study this, like, at all.
Yeah.
And until about like a month and a half ago, you know, if you wanted to study cannabis, you know, in the lab, you had to buy cannabis from the government. They only had one place that they grew it. It was really hard to buy. It wasn't what people were smoking, mm-hmm. you know, in the public. It was very low potency. The THC concentrations were very low. So the people that were able to jump through all those hoops and get that licensing, you know, there was a big question mark of does that research actually translate to the real world, where, you know, people are getting all sorts of different types of products that we just have our hands tied, we're not able to study. Yeah. So, I mean, with respect to your question about like what's going to happen in, you know, 10 to 15 years, I think it'll be really interesting. I mean, the US is really interesting because, you know, certain states like California, Colorado, they were early on to legalize. And there's been a lot of like epidemiologists who were able to study, you know, the effects of legalization in mm-hmm. those states, and then compare it to other states where that wasn't happening. And of course, like we were just talking about, there's differences between states in general. So there's not like a good match for California, but that does give us some initial understanding of what's happening that we can kind of infer, you know, down the road. But in general, like, there needs to be so much more research into how this is happening. And the current scheduling, it's considered a Schedule 1 substance, which, for those of you who don't know, that means high abuse potential and mm-hmm. very low therapeutic potential, which is kind of crazy, because that's the same scheduling level as things like heroin. And cannabis, none of those things apply. Like, we've got FDA approved treatments that are cannabinoids currently. So it's just a big head scratcher. And I think, you know, as soon as researchers don't have their hands tied, there's a lot more that we could do to really inform the public about, you know, the potential benefits as well as the risks, because there's mm-hmm. certainly, you know, are risks that we know about.
Of course. And yeah, I mean, you know, bureaucracy is a hassle. To say the uh-huh. least. I mean, you know, I get why the people would want to restrict access to things and whatever it is. And, you know, it's kind of been relatively well shown that the so-called war on drugs was a bit of a shit show. well-intentioned, perhaps, we could say.
Sure.
But poor execution. But, yeah, I mean, it's really weird, and I don't know why. Excuse me. I don't know why things happened the way they did. They just kind of did, right? And we're sort of always moving to make it better and trying to see where we went wrong as a collective, you know, and make those adjustments. But like, what's interesting about cannabis to me is that, And I actually have this interest with like tobacco leaves as well, where it's like, well, these things have been used medicinally for a long time in human history,
mm-hmm.
right? Like thousands of years. Not exactly sure how they were used so long ago, because, you know, we don't have records or things like that, but all the time. I mean, I guess there's some, but they've been used for thousands of years medicinally and, you know, probably with reasonable success if they continue to do so. And
yeah.
I mean, I guess like, because I always wondered, like, how come tobacco is such a huge thing, right? And so many mm-hmm. people smoke, and in all cultures, just about. Mm-hmm. And like, if like prior to the sort of modern day cigarette industry, it was still a thriving thing just for a long time. And people were doing it wherever they were at, whether it was in the form of like cigars or in pipes or, you know, whatever. Or like self-rolled, I suppose. And it's interesting that it's like has these terrible effects on people, but that never seemed to be a problem up until fairly recently. And my guess, which is an uneducated guess, but my guess would be that, well, our lifespans have increased so drastically mm-hmm. that now we can actually get a chance to see what happens. You know, if your yeah. lifespan was limited to like 50, then, you know, and you could probably smoke as much as you want and you'd probably be fine and not see the consequences of it. But as soon as you push that right. to 100, all the cancer developments start to come through, right?
Exactly, yeah.
What do you think about that? Do you think that's somewhat right?
Yeah, as you were saying it, that's kind of what I was thinking as well. Mm-hmm. And like diseases of aging now, where we're talking about like Alzheimer's, these things are becoming, I mean, that's been around for a long time, obviously, too. But you're exactly right. Like as our lifespan is, you know, well, now it's kind of stagnated. But in recent years, it has really increased.
Yeah.
We're starting to see, you know, those things come up and really be prevalent.
Yeah. But no, it's just an interesting question about how it's been used for so long, you know, medicinally speaking. And from, mm-hmm. you know, from a personal perspective, it's like with cannabis, it's like, I don't, you know, have strong opinions on legalization of things. I think that there's probably a pretty good argument that criminalization of any drug is bad, at least in terms mm-hmm. of like ownership or usage. You know, distribution and production perhaps is a different question. You know, you want that, I suppose, regulated if you can for safety purposes. But it's like there's definitely the surge in cannabis use that will happen now with the legalization. And, you know, people's perceptions of it, particularly, you know, older generations who have grown up with the narrative that it's like a hardcore illegal drug that's, you know, mm-hmm. on par with heroin and crack cocaine and things like that, or notoriously known as the gateway drug to harder drugs, like that's starting to change. And you can kind of just see mm-hmm. it, you know, just with like parental attitudes towards it. I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't like to be a parent raising like a teenager at the moment and having to try and negotiate right. through that. Because, I mean, yeah, like, what are the effects on teenagers? Like, you know, it probably is not great.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things we're starting to study, just because there's a big question mark. We don't mm-hmm. know how it affects the developing brain. The preliminary stuff that we've seen shows that you should probably wait until you're an adult. So I think, you know, one of the things that we're seeing is that, like you said, perceptions of risk across the board have really gone down. And like, what does that say for, you know, kids and teenagers who are being exposed to these substances at very high potency? So like the changes that we're seeing are usually for, you know, the very high potency THC. It's not just like the 2% or something like that, but it's, and, you know, those things are becoming more common. The other kind of vulnerable population is pregnant moms. So dispensaries are sometimes, you know, advertising cannabis as a way to deal with morning sickness. And the evidence is a little bit more clear there that that actually has detrimental effects on the unborn child. So I think it's going to be interesting. I think there just needs to be more understanding about the risks and be clear about some of the benefits that we do know, especially in older adults who have, I'm glad you mentioned that, though. That's actually the biggest population where cannabis use is growing is older adults. And there is a lot of evidence that cannabis can, you know, help lower pain levels. So dealing with things like arthritis, anxiety potentially, which is one of the main reasons people self-report that they use cannabis. But it's so difficult too, because physicians aren't educated on how to, you know, talk to their patients about these things. So it's like a whole, like the whole society is not prepared to talk about this, not prepared to talk about the science, and the science is still lacking, partially too, because these things were only discovered, you know, from the medical side of things only a couple decades ago. Like we didn't even know what cannabis binds to in the body until like the 70s, which is crazy because, like you said, people have been using this thing for thousands of years.
No, that's true. And it's interesting because I guess like younger populations were using it anyway, it was just illegal or whatever. And so once it became legal, it opened up access to people who wouldn't have otherwise tried it or whatever. And I mean, I think it has, as you say, it has potential for huge medical benefits if used properly. And of course, you know, I don't know about all, but many substances are a risk of abuse, right? Because people use it, they feel good, and then they just want to keep going, right? And that makes sense. I mean, it's a sort of human nature for a lot of people or whatever it is. And it also, it's not going to do well for everyone. Some people are probably going to have really adverse reactions to it. Spike, like increases in anxiety and depression. And so it's not like it's a no risk option. But yeah. And I mean, yeah, it's like, I guess like alcohol was also, you know, at some point they were like, no pregnant ladies should drink. That's not a good idea. Don't do that.
And now it's pretty clear. I think those are all things that science is trying to figure out now. Are there certain genetic backgrounds, certain demographics that cannabis should not, you know, is not recommended for? And one thing that I do want the listeners to know is that with the respect to anxiety, a lot of people are familiar with stories of people taking, you know, an edible or something and having a panic attack that lasts for a long time. Edibles do stay in your system a long time. So if you do take them, you know, do not repeat dosing until like 3 hours later, because it's going to take a while for it to reach max levels. But the kind of anxiety inducing effects are dose dependent. So higher doses, you're more likely to get that anxiety, you know, inducing effect versus reducing anxiety, which is what most people want. So just wanted to mention that, that it is very dose dependent. It does seem to have this like biphasic response where low doses help with anxiety. High doses can actually make it a lot worse.
Yeah. It's very interesting. Why does it have that? What's the, is it known? Like, do you know why, what the mechanism of that is?
They're still trying to figure that out. And same with CBD, which we haven't talked much about. So cannabidiol is another interesting compound that seems to be everywhere now, in toilet paper and gummies and everything. And it's a really interesting compound. So THC is the main molecule that people will be familiar with. It's the molecule that causes you to become high. It's what people usually, you know, want to get out of cannabis, but the cannabis plant itself has hundreds of different cannabinoids. They're still discovering what's in the plant. Cannabinoids are just molecules. THC and CBD are two of them. CBD is not psychoactive, so it doesn't get you high. That body of research and how CBD affects people is so young. But initially what we know in terms of like anxiety levels is that there seems to be kind of a sweet spot where too little doesn't really do anything. You know, moderate doses seem to be kind of the sweet spot. Too much is actually has no effect as well. But again, those are things we're trying to figure out. Mm-hmm. But CBD, you know, is really interesting to me because we know it can affect the brain very clearly, because one of the reasons that it's so popular, you know, in medicine right now is because we've got an FDA-approved CBD drug called Epidiolex, which very robustly reduces seizures in kids with epilepsy. Wow. So where no other types of anti-epilepsy drugs work, you know, CBD is really able to reduce seizures in these kids, which is a huge quality of life issue.
Yeah.
And, you know, back to the legalization thing, like the fact that CBD was not available to some people, they're actually moving to Colorado. There's some very famous cases of like the Charlotte's Web cannabis strain where parents were moving their family to Colorado to get their kid treatment that wasn't accessible anywhere else. Like, that is so interesting to me too, because it's very clearly affecting the brain somehow if it's reducing seizures, which happen in the brain. So
yeah, absolutely.
Very interesting area.
Yeah, for sure. And it you know, presumably like the medical side of things will focus more on the non-psychoactive parts of cannabis, right? Because I guess you want to be able to give people things that aren't going to get them high so that they can function somewhat normally, but maybe not necessarily. I don't know. We'll see how it goes, I suppose.
I guess there's
with kids
a couple
specifically,
like,
though. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You want to kind of stay away from the THC is what we found. But at least for things like pain, I know they have a couple experimental drugs that are in clinical trials that are like 50-50 THC and CBD. Mm. And that combination seems to work really well together. And the CBD kind of tends to reduce the psychoactive part of THC. But again, it's really tricky because what tends to work, honestly, the best is the whole plant. Mm. So if you extract the whole plant, there seems to be something about that whole collection of, you know, 100 plus cannabinoids and other molecules like terpenes that we don't totally understand. Them working together seems to have really, you know, maximum therapeutic effect. So it'll be interesting. But I did want to mention too, another interesting area is my former postdoctoral mentor, Christine Rabinac, who's at Wayne State as well. She's actually doing some really cool work on THC, specifically for people with PTSD.
Mm.
And that's actually looking like it's a very effective treatment in conjunction with things like cognitive behavioral therapy. So it's actually making that therapy work better. So that'll be very exciting to see, you know, the kind of therapeutic, you know, benefits of just THC alone. If for people with PTSD or struggling with other anxiety disorders.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating and, you know, very exciting that these treatments are being studied and hopefully, if successful, will be used, you know, to help people with all sorts of complex, you know, psycho-emotional problems, I suppose. And it's amazing that we can do that now and that it might be accessible to people and that it might be, you know, doesn't come with heavy side effects or consequences to like a lot of other drugs that are out there. Not that people shouldn't be taking those. I mean, if you need them, you know, take them from your doctor. But it's interesting just how, like, you know, I mean, it blows my mind that like one plant can do all this crazy shit. And it's just, I mean, it's not even like a fancy or like artificially selected plant. It's just like, no, like it's fairly naturally grown. I mean, it's been controlled for a while, but you know, it is just somewhat, I mean, listen, to be fair, just because it's a plant doesn't mean it's good for you, you know. Like when people talk about organic stuff, I'm like, okay, but organic doesn't mean healthy. Like snake venom is technically organic, If you take some of that, it's not going to go well for you. But
good example, you know, yeah.
It's like it doesn't mean that it's good. It just means that it's mm-hmm. not synthesized in a lab, I suppose.
Right.
Which isn't also always a bad thing. We have lots of wonderful drugs that people take for all kinds of conditions, and we have antibiotics, we have antipsychotics, antidepressants, and mm-hmm. all things that are really helpful to people that are synthesized in a lab. So it's not all bad, mm-hmm. but it would be cool when we can do it without the side effects that often come with them, right?
Absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting field, and I think that it's going to be fascinating to see what happens, right, in the next few decades, and hopefully not too many people will get caught up in the crossfires or, try too much without having the science there first and suffering the consequences of it. But, people will do what they will.
Yeah, I think that going back to the earlier conversation about education, like that'll be the biggest component. It's just making sure that, our pharmacists, our physicians, nurses, they're all educated on how to talk to patients about these things and really give them, the resources to make informed decisions about whether or not they want to use. And, if so, like what product to use and the route of administration. So is smoking better in this case, or is it, an edible? And I think that's probably the biggest thing that will help in addition to the science moving along.
Well, I suppose the science, in some regard has to come first so that they can make educated mm-hmm. recommendations.
Absolutely.
But you're right, because as it stands at the moment, like you walk into a dispensary and you're just greeted with like 100 options. And you're like, well, I mean, how do I know anything? Or how am I supposed to know stuff? And, I guess a lot of the information that's out there is relatively anecdotal in terms of like effects and what's it used for. And I mean, that's fine. It helps, I guess. And you get the people in the dispensaries who are somewhat knowledgeable on the topics and mm-hmm. how people have reported what they prefer and how it affects them and what right. does what. Which is good. I mean, it's better than nothing, I suppose. It's better than just mm-hmm. looking at it and being like, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, and just choosing that way.
Yeah. Again, it's been so yeah. hard to study. And a lot of the dispensaries have actually done a really good job of trying to track, their products and how people are responding. There's something called the Relief app, which I really recommend. I'm working with them on a study to track some CBD products, but it's an app for people. They have a bunch of different dispensaries actually on it where you yourself can do an experiment and you can say like, hey, I went to this dispensary, I bought this product, and I'm going to track, if I'm taking it for pain, I'm going to track my pain levels. And at the end of it, you can have kind of a collection of, what products did I try? Which ones work for me? You can see like other strains and how they're rated, how they've helped people. Like you said, it's not perfect. It's all self-report and, it's not like perfectly done. Yeah, it's a very useful tool, I think, for people who are trying to make informed decisions.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. Because, as things stand, like it's brilliant because even if there were science behind it, like medications still affect people differently, right? And mm-hmm. you still have to test it out on you and see how it goes. I mean, if you go to like when I've been to psychiatrists for whatever, they're like, okay, let's try this medication. And mm-hmm. that's somewhat comforting, but somewhat unnerving to be like, what do you mean try? And they're like, well, sometimes it doesn't work. And I'm like, mm-hmm. okay, I guess we have, it's a test, try and fail, what's it called, or something like that. And that's just how it is at the moment, right? And you mm-hmm. do it because you have to, and you take note and you see how it goes and you change if need be and try other things. And so it's not so different, it's just much less controlled, and it's more in your hands.
I mean, that's something that like a lot of neuroscientists are trying to work on too. Or is there something that we can look at a person and look at their genetic background or look at their brain structure function and say, hey, is this specific medication likely to be effective or not? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of research going on there where we're, you know, studying people and then giving them the drug and seeing if it benefited them. Because all of those medications, especially antidepressants, they work like 50%, I think is the rate for people. So a lot of people, like you said, have to, you know, come off one drug because it didn't work and go into another drug. And that's a very long process. Mm-hmm. So using science to try to get that process a lot shorter and say like, hey, this is someone's neurobiology, what type of medication or what class of medication is likely to work for them? That's a very exciting area too. And hopefully that will make things a lot easier for patients.
Yeah. And it is advancing quite well. I mean, I recently had a, like it wasn't so recently, but I had like a genetic screening test done. And it basically outlined, according to, you know, this company, which is great, that all the medications that are likely to have positive responses in me versus neutral versus adverse response or non-response. And so I have this list of like, I don't know, it must be like 100 different types of medications, not just psychopharmaceuticals, but like, you know, antibiotics, pain killers, whatever, you know, the whole suite. And it was just really cool. And I mean, I don't know the exact accuracy or science of how it works, but, you know, from like anecdotal experience, when I looked at it, I was like, oh, that makes sense, because I'd take that and it doesn't work, or I had to take a very high dose before it would start working because I'm a fast metabolizer of it. And so it's really cool that all this stuff is coming together and can be utilized to really give people the best chance at whatever it is they're trying to deal with, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, on a high note too, like it's a really exciting time to be in psychiatry because a lot of new treatments are coming out, like ketamine for depression, MDMA or ecstasy for PTSD, for MDMA assisted like psychotherapy. You know, the US, the National Institutes of Health is really heavily investing in cannabinoids and cannabis research. So, you know, those are all promising things. There's a lot of push right now into understanding these compounds and the effects, you know, good and bad on humans. So I'm hopeful. I think it'll be really exciting in the next couple of years, and we'll see a lot of new treatments coming down the pike that can actually help people.
Yeah, that's amazing. And, you know, I'm excited for it, and I'm excited for people to have that opportunity to get the help that they need, you know? Well, listen, I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. Thank you very much for coming on the show today. Is there anything you would like to plug? You know, your podcast, your website? What would you like to tell people?
Yeah. Thank you for that. This was awesome. I think we should have scheduled like a 5-hour talk, but lots in common. Very, very cool discussion. Yeah. If anyone's interested in my podcast, it's called BrainSTEM. An educational podcast about the brain. Each episode, for the most part, focuses on a different brain disorder. I try to give voice to people who are affected by the disorder. So have an episode on schizophrenia coming up where I interview a person affected and then an expert who studies the brain basis or treats that disorder.
Amazing.
So check that out. It's available on Spotify, Apple, Google, anywhere you can find a podcast. And then, yeah, if anyone's interested in hearing about my research, I direct the Think Lab, and the website is WSUThinkLab.com. So, that's where you can read all about us.
Fantastic. I would highly recommend everyone check that out. And I'd love to have you on again sometime soon and continue the conversation. But until then, thank you and keep well.
Thanks, Jane.
Bye.